Alan Kohler here, and I'm talking to Dr. Jerome Lander, who is the portfolio manager of Lucerne Alternative Investments Fund, which is a $65 million fund of funds. That is to say, they invest in other portfolio managers, international and Australian, and the minimum investment is $50,000. They've got two sets of fees. You can either pay 1.15% flat, or you can pay 0.4% plus a 12% performance fee, and the benchmark for the performance fee is zero. So, but they've been doing pretty well. The whole plan is to ensure that you're protected, or their clients are protected from big falls in the market. So they don't aim at getting 15 or 20 or 25% performance. They aim at getting something close to 10%, but without the big falls. That's the plan. And I think they've probably succeeded in doing that so far. But apart from all that, it's very interesting to talk to Jerome about his views about the market, because he thinks we're in a bubble, and that he's therefore investing quite a lot in gold, been doing well, quite well out of gold, obviously, but he is, you'd have to say, pessimistic, or he thinks that there is a difficult time ahead of us because of the fact, in his view, that we are in a bubble. So I think it's well worth having a listen to Dr. Jerome Lander, portfolio manager for Lucerne Alternative Investments Fund. Jerome Lander, I take it Lucerne Investment Partners, or your fund at least, is a fund of funds. That's correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's a multi-asset, multi-strategy fund of funds, effectively, or a fund of different underlying strategies.
And how many other funds do you invest in?
About 12 to 15 at any point in time, different underlying strategies, which can typically funds, but can be other things as well. So we're not precluded from investing in ETFs or other strategies if we think they're more appropriate in terms of getting the exposures we want. But most of the things we do are certainly underlying funds.
And are they Australian or international?
Mixture of both. So we're really looking for the best opportunities globally that we can get our heads around. That fulfill the exposures we want, and combining them in a way which makes sense to get the objectives of the fund met.
And how do you choose them?
Well, it's a pretty thorough process for choosing them. So obviously, there's a lot of funds out there to choose from. And so one thing is actually, you know, being able to screen the universe for things that look interesting and that fulfill the requirements that you're looking for. And another thing is then looking at them in detail and during the bottom-up research on the fund managers. But I mean, I'm trained in manager selection. I've been doing it an awful long time. So I've got a thorough process to go through to decide whether someone's going to be evaluating or not. And I follow that process. So, you know, it's very much based on what you might call, you know, multiple P process, people process, philosophy, a lot of the traditional things, performance analysis of same things you're looking for.
So do you feel like taking us through the process?
Yeah, I can. So in brief, it's detailed, but I'll try. So, you know, top down in terms of the fund, obviously we've got certain objectives. So we're looking for funds that contribute to those objectives. And in particular, because the fund is actually designed in terms of being diversified, we're very interested in strategies that are complementary to what we've already got. So we've got a bias straight away to looking for strategies which fit into what we've already got in the portfolio and where we think the market's going and what risk we think we need to manage. So very much there's a flavour in terms of a top-down thematic type flavour to what we might be looking for at a point in time and screen the universe for. Like, fund managers are approaching me all the time to get me to look at their strategies. And I tend to start then with, well, am I interested in this sort of type of strategy in terms of what I'm looking for? And then secondly, I'll ask them for a lot of material, a lot of written material that retail investors typically won't get access to. So the things like due diligence questionnaires, the presentations, the monthlies, anything they've written, I'll read through all that material, because I tend to find that that's the fastest way to get to the crunch in terms of whether the manager might or might not be of interest to me. I'll ask for things like attribution and analyze the performance. I'll understand the performance in the context of where the market's.
What do you mean by attribution?
Well, it's looking at if a fund manager's got a performance track record, which typically they do have some sort of performance track record, it's understanding where that performance has come from. So you might say, well, you know, you've done this performance, where's that come from? You might have a chat to the manager, but you can also ask for formal attribution, which basically breaks down, you know, where the performance has actually come from. And then very importantly, that doesn't really tell you a lot in isolation. You really need to understand what's going on in the markets to get a flavour for how the manager invests and where they've made the money from. So that's really breaking down the past performance aspect of it. I wouldn't want to overemphasise that in the first instance, because it's really not a strong strong part of our process to begin with. I think a lot of people are very interested in past performance of fund managers, and they get they make the mistake of actually being kind of tricked into following past performance. And most market participants actually invest on the basis of simple nominal past performance. We know that from the way funds flow. And so the trick is really to get away from that bias. One of the ways you do that is really understanding, well, you know, obviously at the moment, if you're a tech fund, you've probably got outstanding performance because, you know, a lot of tech funds have outstanding performance because tech's been flying. So you need to understand, you know, where the performance has come from, how much of it has come from tech, and how much has it come from the manager doing something special beyond that. How much has it come from the manager choosing to invest in tech as opposed to investing in something else? Questions like that. So having done that screening process, I'll then you know, pick up the phone or go and see the fund manager and ask them a series of questions which probably fill in the gaps for what I'm interested in looking at specifically. So I'll vary every time in terms of what I'm actually interested in finding out from the fund manager to begin with. Then if they pass that process, I'll look at the manager in detail by actually going through a, you know, due diligence process with them, whereby I'll, you know, I'll actually look at the, you know, the business, assess the business, assess the people, assess the philosophy, assess the process, assess the performance that I talked about, and then understand the context in terms of what we're looking for going forward. Really think about the risk management. It's clearly a big part of winning is not losing. It's certainly a big philosophy in our fund, and what we offer investors is avoiding the big losses. So, you know, risk management is critical to long-term compounding and avoiding big losses. And it's a mistake that, you know, you'll hear lots of people say, look, we invested in this great fund, but they forget about all the ones, the mistakes they made. And one of the things I think we offer as professionals, hopefully to investors, is that we make less mistakes. So not only can we pick great fund managers, but we can also avoid making as many mistakes as other people. And that makes a big difference to performance as well.
To what extent is it based on the character of the person running the fund? And if so, what are you looking for?
Well, yeah, look, I think the people assessment is critical. This is a people business funds management. So I'm really interested in investors who care about their clients. I'm personally motivated to do that. I actually think the funds management industry, you know, really should be about serving the client first and foremost, as should the entire finance industry, and people who are interested in a win-win. So, you know, the way managers are prepared to structure their fees, the way they've actually carried themselves in the past, their reputation within the marketplace, the way they act, their motivations, all of these things come into the assessment of a fund manager. One of the big mistakes that fund managers make is they become too big. There's a misalignment often between what's important to the business and what's important to the client in terms of getting performance. So a lot of fund managers, you know, want to get bigger because they make more money through scale, of course, and that's fair enough to some extent. But you know, you need to get past the point where you can actually make some money. But a lot of them become too greedy, especially large institutions who tend to keep pushing the fund managers to take on more and more farm. And because people are so past performance orientated, they tend to kill the prospects. You know, that what was true in the beginning isn't true in the end by the time many people come to looking at a fund manager. So it's understanding, you know, how much money can individual managers actually manage effectively. And that's really an assessment of capacity of the individual manager's strategy. It's quite a nuanced assessment, sophisticated assessment. I'm interested in that as well. Because clearly that's important to whether the fund manager, even if they are very capable and very motivated, are actually capable of performing in the way that they were before. The opportunity set, you know, what's the manager looking at? I mean, I follow the market very closely, so I've got a very good idea with individual strategies whether the manager has a good opportunity set or not, or whether it's going to be tough for them in terms of the outlook. And that really will change, you know, the weightings we'll give to different strategies at a point in time quite significantly. So we don't believe in just backing fund managers and then sticking with them forever. There's certain fund managers you can do that for, but we think very importantly, there's actually a understanding the context in which the fund manager operates and whether the manager should be, you know, given more weight or less weight in the overall portfolio, their contribution in terms of the overall portfolio. That's critical.
Just focusing on fees now, you seem to have two types of fees. You've got class one and class two. The class one is a straight fee of 1.15%, no performance fee, but then class two is 0.4% management fee and 12% performance fee. Why have you done that?
Well, it's really about giving investors the option. So many investors choose the performance fee orientated option because they want to pay very low base fees if you don't actually perform. Which is fair enough, and only pay if you actually do deliver a strong performance. But you know, some invoices are happy to just have a fixed fee amount that they know they're looking at. So it's really about giving the investors the option, I think.
And what's your benchmark for the performance fee?
Well, the benchmark is an absolute return product. So the benchmark is actually low, given there's no base fee. The base fee is basically just covering costs in that circumstance, or basic costs. It really starts from zero in that case. But the performance fee is only 12%, including GST. So it's fair enough in terms of the context of what the fund's actually aiming to achieve, which is, you know, around 7%.
Did you say your benchmark is zero? I mean, it says here that your benchmark is RBA cash rate plus 6%.
Yeah, the target for the fund, that's the target objective for the fund. So the fund's aiming to deliver a return of around, you know, 7 to 10% sort of thing over time.
I see, but that's not your benchmark for the performance fee. The performance fee benchmark is zero.
Correct. In that performance fee structure, that's right, because the base fee is so low. So typically when you look at a fund manager, they'll charge you a base fee of, you know, 1% or something and a 20% performance fee. We're charging in that performance fee structure option a 0.4% base fee, which is obviously very, very low. And in order to make money, we obviously have to, you know, have a performance fee. The fund isn't a shoot the lights fund. You know, we're not trying to do 20% per annum. That's not the objective of the fund. So if the fund does deliver 10% per annum, then you can work out that, you know, you can work out what the fees are. But if it doesn't, investors aren't going to pay a lot for it. I think that's the alignment that's there in the performance fee option.
So what about the fact that all the funds you invest in also charge a fee? So you've got two layers of fees. Do you calculate and tell your investors what the total fees are?
Well, the answer is we can, but the answer is we don't, because we're focused on net of fee returns. So one of the great things about being a professional, you know, fund manager selector and fund of funds manager is that, you know, we don't pay the same fees that you would pay, someone else would pay if they just go to the fund manager directly. We're able to negotiate fees that's in many cases more than offset our own fees. So that's part of the offering is obviously, you know, you're paying us in order to get a cheaper price to access, you know, outstanding fund managers, but we're also managing the allocations to those fund managers. We're also deciding which ones we should invest in and which ones we should avoid. We're deciding when to be invested in how much, et cetera. So there's a lot of different things that we offer for the price we're charging, I guess. And at the end of the day, the thing that really matters, this industry is absolutely obsessed with fees, but it's not the fees that a fund manager charges that really matters. It's the net of fee return that gets delivered to the client. And so if you look at our net of fee returns that we've actually delivered to clients since I've been managing the fund, they're second to none in the industry. So, and they're substantially higher than other similar strategies. And that's ultimately, last year we delivered, last financial year when, you know, the future fund went backwards and most super funds went backwards, they delivered a negative return. We delivered a 6.9% net return after all fees and costs to investors from this multi-asset diversified strategy. So that was, you know, about 8% better than other sort of the average sort of, you know, large super fund or many other multi-asset strategies. It was, I think, nearly 17% better than Australian equities, and that's the net of fee return to the client that's being delivered. So I think that, you know, our fees are very reasonable in the context of what we're actually offering investors. If you look since that period of time, we've actually done substantially better since the 30th of June. So we're actually now delivering, since I started, running ahead of target, I guess, we're delivering more than 1% a month on average in terms of the return, which is outstanding in the context we've had. And that's the net of fee return to the client. And ultimately, that's what clients need. They need a net of fee return. So if we're able to negotiate great fees with underlying fund managers and we're able to do all of that for about 1%, but in the effective cost to their clients, actually substantially less or nearly nothing in many cases, then I think that's a great outcome that's being delivered for clients. And that's very important to me personally.
In your own attribution in the monthly in July, the July monthly, it's got 2.07% convertibles. What does that mean?
Well, we invest in a number of different underlying strategies, and some of them are quite sophisticated. So, convertible bonds are basically, you know, one of the fund managers we invest in convertibles basically, or, you know, you think about convertible equity and convertible bonds and that sort of asset class. So that's what that refers to. That attribution came from a fund manager that delivered very strong performance in that particular month.
And the second highest attribution, interestingly, I was interested in this, was gold. So how do you invest in gold?
Well, look, this comes down to the value add in the strategy as well, and I'll go into this a little bit of detail. So we're not just about individual fund managers and what they can deliver. What we want is the best implementation of a particular exposure, and if a fund manager can contribute to that, then we'll choose them. If not, but a lot of the value add actually comes from us choosing, you know, thematically or understanding the macro environment and being able to understand when you should be in an asset and when you shouldn't. So if you go back a year, as soon as I took over the funding, in fact, the first thing I did was put in a meaningful gold exposure. And I was of the view that gold had only one way to go, and that was up. We've now seen, you know, in all likelihood, we've now seen that come to fruition with gold being flavour of the month. But I still think it could go further. But I then looked for what's the best expression of this exposure? Because I was so bullish on gold, I chose to actually identify a fund manager that would basically had a bias to being, you know, good performance in bull markets. So they did well if the market tended to go up or gold tended to go up and tended to leverage that benefit. And we've had, you know, very strong performance from that fund manager since that time. So it gives an idea of how the top-down and bottom-up aspects come together. The fund manager's done a great job, but we've also done a great job in actually choosing to invest in them and have that asset class exposure in the first place.
But does that asset – I just didn't understand what you're saying. Does that asset manager – does that fund manager actually invest in gold, or do they just do well when gold is going up?
They invest in gold stocks, actually, in this situation. So gold stocks tend to do about 2.5 times as well as gold in a gold bull market. They can invest in other things as well. They also have a bit of silver exposure, which has been beneficial. But you know, we could choose to, we certainly considered gold itself in terms of being something we could invest in and might invest in the future. But at that point in time, we decided that was the best way to gain that exposure. So the thing about this fund is it's very dynamic. So we're constantly looking at the best way to get an exposure and the best way to manage the risk of the portfolio. So it's risk and opportunity are both things we're considering very much so, and particularly risk, actually. They're very interested in the risk contribution to the portfolio as a whole. So if we're going to go and put in a gold exposure, we need to understand when that gold exposure might not do so well and what might do well in that circumstance, and think about having offsetting exposures in the funds. The fund as a whole does well, and that sort of risk management's really, really contributed to us having such strong protection in terms of the earlier part of the year. So the diversification in the portfolio is very much an all weather fund, where we're always trying to get diversification and have diversification in the portfolio, no matter what we think, no matter how strong our views are. And so not only did I publish on the fact that the coronavirus was going to smash markets earlier this year, so we were prepared for that, but the diversification inherently helps protect us as well from any one exposure in the fund working or not working, whether that's gold or something else.
You've also got more than half of your money in long-short equities.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more in long-short funds than in long-only funds.
Mm-hmm.
Explain why is that?
Well, we're an absolute return strategy. So, you know, one of the things I think that's missing from the industry is a real alignment with what clients actually want for how their money is managed. So a lot of people are focused on, you know, equities. Well, guess what? Equities alone don't give you what the client actually wants. And the reason for that is that they can fall 30 or 50%, especially from where we're starting today, very easily. And that's not what clients want. Clients don't want to lose a lot of money. Furthermore, it doesn't help you build long-term performance if you lose lots of money. And you have to avoid having big drawdowns if you want to compound capital over a long period of time. So a long-only managers by themselves aren't enough to build a good portfolio at the current time, either in isolation or especially when considering what clients actually want for their money and what they actually need. So, you know, how do you do that? Well, this strategy is really built around doing that. It's really about seeing that there's a gap in the marketplace for fund managers who actually align, who actually use all their skills and all the things you can do to actually target a risk return outcome which is aligned with what clients actually want. And I personally think, and very much believe this from all my experience in the industry, that people want a kind of, you know, close to 10% return or high single digit return with low risk of losses, low risk of very large losses. They're happy to take some losses, but they don't want huge losses. So design a strategy around that that does that as a whole. And that's what we do. And the bias towards long short comes in for that reason. So if you just loaded a portfolio with long only funds, it'd be a very different strategy from what we're running. I'm sure it might do better in a bull market, or should do better in a bull market, but it will also blow you up every so often, especially into the environment we're going into in the future. So what you need to do then is consider, well, how do the underlying strategies, how do we combine them as a whole to get the result we want, and which individual strategies do we need to use? And clearly, given that absolute return focus, given the desire not to lose 10%, given the desire to have high single-digit returns and have positive skew rather than a negative skew to the results, that's to say that we're more likely to produce upside performance than we are downside performance. You know, the long-short bias makes a lot of sense in the portfolio. That is to say, it really does help protect you from those big falls in markets. Now, clearly, long-short.
I presume that, Jerome, that's because you think we're in a bubble. I'm quoting from your quarterly now, where you say, simply put, prices have become divorced from their fundamentals. We refer to this as a bubble, quite possibly the greatest bubble the world has ever seen.
Yep.
I mean, I haven't read anything quite as clear and definitive as that. Well, not many things anyway. So that's what you think? To explain?
Yes, I actually really think that we are operating in a bubble in financial markets, and it's driven by you know, many, many years of pushing interest rates down to very low levels and actually, you know, financialising the economy and pushing asset prices higher and higher and higher. And we can see evidence of that. The coronavirus comes along, the markets get absolutely smashed. And in order to get them to recover, you need to actually provide unprecedented stimulus. So that the amount of stimulus that's been applied to these markets to get them back up to where they are today is extraordinary. It's done in the face of a massive recession. So the actual damage to the ground to economies is very substantive. It's huge, right? We would be in a depression were it not for the abnormal stimulation and policies that have been enacted. So the point around the bubble is that this bubble is driven by policy. It's driven by government policy, monetary and fiscal policy. And to keep the show on the road, to keep asset markets this elevated, has required quite an extraordinary and massive effort on the part of policymakers. Asset prices now are extremely high if looked at on a valuation basis. And we're looking at S&P or the US stock market being on 40 times this year's earnings. Who knows what next year's earnings are going to be like, but presumably they'll be a bit better versus a long-term average of 16 times. We're looking at market cap to GDP or the size of the markets versus the size of the real economy being at all-time record highs by, you know, and approaching, you know, a few days ago was approaching 180%, which is just huge versus, you know, where you might argue they should be of around, well, these depend upon a lot of factors, but in substantively lower levels. So there's, you know, there's a huge bubble in traditional defensive assets such as cash and bonds. You know, cash is yielding next to nothing and bonds are yielding next to nothing. And clearly those prices don't resemble a reasonable return for those assets, given inflation and real inflation in the economy and all that sort of stuff. So, or a reasonable return on capital for people wanting to invest in those things. They require basically speculation on the fact that interest rates will go lower and that even more stimulus we provide in the future will be required in order to justify those prices. So when you've got the risk-free rate being basically manipulated by government policy to such a low level and everything else basically priced off that, then I think you can quite easily, as I do, argue that we are in the biggest bubble of all time, because it affects just so many things across asset markets.
You also say that a market that depends solely on government largesse to go up isn't a safe market, but can you see that there is an argument to say that maybe a market that depends on government largesse is quite safe, in fact? But safer.
Well, I'll tell you why I don't think it's safe. Yeah, I think I'll tell you two reasons why I don't think it's safe, Alan. That's a really good point and to make. You know, because a lot of people believe that, right? It's a really important point to address directly.
No, but arguably the market that depends on, you know, the capitalist system or the market itself and investors going along as usual is not safe, because that's what we found in the past.
No, well, I don't really agree with that. I'll tell you what would be a safe market. A safe market, or a more attractive market from a risk return point of view, and obviously they're sort of all safe, it would be if asset valuations were cheap. So we're in the early 1980s. We had interest rates already being very high and likely to come down, like we were in the early 1980s. And the economy was capable of producing, you know, very good growth. It wasn't requiring great deals of government support. You weren't overly leveraged with huge amounts of debt. I mean, that'd be a much safer market to invest in than what we're in today. Today, we're in a market where we've stimulated the crap out of the market, to be frank, and we've got huge amounts of debt. We can't really pay back these debts under normal circumstances. We require government to help us out massively. There's huge amounts of stimulation required to keep the market up. As soon as we hit any sort of meaningful catalyst, the market falls apart completely. And further, you know, it's never safe to be investing in a market which depends upon only one thing. And really, and I think quite clearly, the market as a whole really does depend upon government largesse to keep up here, to be up here. So it's only one thing. We've learned over time that central bankers, you know, globally aren't reliable parties. We don't know what they're going to do next when they decide to change their tune. We don't know, for example, about some of the things that come along. We tend to be followers of what's going on in the market rather than leaders. We know that there's a huge number of risk factors out there that could cause massive problems for markets, you know, geopolitical disturbances. We could see inflation coming back in the next few years big time. There's all sorts of things which should be massive catalysts for these markets, which would hurt them. And I'm personally expecting that we will be rolling through a series of repeated crises because we are living in la-la land, frankly.
So what does that do to – how does that affect your strategy, your investment strategy? I mean, in particular, does it lead you to be quite short? I mean, how much of your portfolio is short?
Well, I think it's dangerous to be net short, right? So I don't believe personally, despite your view onto the market, you should then say, right, we're going to be shorting the whole market because, you know, we don't know exactly when things are going to fall over. But what it does lend me to do is actually have a low market exposure and really depend upon returns from other factors, such idiosyncratic returns, more
such
active
as,
management.
Such as gold.
And other things which clearly will be, you know, have a much better chance of being protective or going up if things are adverse, such as gold in that circumstance. I guess the other thing that's great about this sort of environment we're going into the next few years, which I really expect we'll see, you know, very low to zero sort of real returns off most asset classes, and I think you'll see that reflected in performances that most diversified funds and fund managers actually deliver over time, over a multi-year basis, is that, you know, these repeated crises and all this volatility provides great opportunities for active managers, actually. So we're entering a period which is very different from where we've been in the last 10 or 20 years. We're entering into a very exciting investment environment whereby great active management will be rewarded. And so I want the returns to depend very much upon that great active management, not upon markets remaining inflated by government largesse, if you like. And I think that's a very exciting environment for us because, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. We've seen that already earlier this year. We've seen most fund managers fall over completely in February and March. If it weren't for the government largesse, they wouldn't be here probably. And we saw that in the GFC and we've seen that many times before. And I think we'll continue to see that. But if we get a multi-year basis where investors eventually will work out, hang on a second, the fund manager I'm investing in really isn't offering me anything. Without the markets going up, they're not able to make me a return. That's not what investors want. Investors actually want you to make them a return. They're not interested in gambling on whether the stock market goes up or down or any of that sort of stuff. They actually want you to make them a return. So we've built this strategy to make investors return pretty much no matter what happens. It's an all-weather fund. The strategies is the multiple strategies we use underlying the fund are designed to complement each other, and we're designed to defend and protect capital in the subsequent big drawdowns we'll see going forward, I think. But, you know, if the market goes up and everyone makes money, that's great. You know, we will too. But what if it doesn't? What if it's flat? You know, in those circumstances, this is where we're really going to look very, very strong relatively.
So what do you think the market's going to do next year or the rest of this year?
The rest of this year, I think we're in for a bit of a challenging period. I think we've obviously got the US elections coming up and, you know, there's riots are building up on the streets. We're coming out of a period where there's been massive speculation in the markets. We've got all sorts of retail investors and SoftBank buying call options on markets to which have been, you know, pushed up tech valuations, and certain elements of the market are looking very frothy and with massive amounts of speculation in them. Other areas of the market are reflecting the real economy, which is dismal and struggling to come back from the coronavirus at the moment. I think we'll see potentially a change in tenor, though, over time, and a lot of opportunities that are created as a result of you know, the changing circumstances with respect to coronavirus treatment and assessment and vaccines, etc. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in the coming period to extract return from the markets, but it's a very risky period coming into the end of this year. I think a lot of people are expecting things to go back to normal. I think that all things to be extremely positive. I think that there's if you juxtapose that against an understanding of the real economy, it's really quite a speculative view to say that. I think we have to operate on the basis that things are going to be, relatively tough, because remember, even before we had COVID-19, we governments were really struggling with their policies to keep growth being positive. We were really, the economy is very imbalanced. There's great wealth dispersion. There's huge amounts of debt out there. We have a huge debt problem that needs to be resolved. A lot of the policies, in my view, aren't really effective policies. They really kick the can down the road type policies. We haven't taken the bull by the horns and said, well, right, how do we actually reform these economies and actually produce real growth? So we've got no real growth happening in economies for a long time already, before we even had this massive crisis come about. And so, we've got lots of things that can cause future crisis. I mean, we look very vulnerable to me. And I think it's very important not to operate on the assumption that the way markets have been in the last 30 to 40 years will be the way we are going forward, because I don't think we will be. I think it'll be a very different period when you look forward. And that's very much what I'm about and what I think good market participants are about. They look forward, not backwards. Whereas most people invest with a backward-looking lens and say, oh, yeah, but everything does 10% or 5% or whatever, therefore we'll continue to do that. Well, no. If the circumstances change, so will the return. And I think that's what I'm arguing with you, that circumstances have changed, that things are different, that we can no longer push interest rates from 10% to zero, and therefore that the drivers of these, we've already stimulated almost as much as we possibly can. It's going to be very difficult to keep these markets inflated, against the odds.
Just finally, Jerome, how much have you got in the fund?
So in terms of Lucerne, people and part families altogether, there's about $3 or $4 million in the fund.
Right, so it's when you say for the family, so that's the total size of your fund. It's $3 or $4 million.
No. In terms of the actual total size of the fund at the moment is $65 million. It's growing quite well, because I think we have demonstrated that we are delivering results, which ultimately what fund manager. The great thing about being in funds management is you can deliver. Your results speak for themselves over time, and we are delivering results which are head and shoulders above the competition. So the fund's actually grown quite nicely. Hopefully we can make more people aware of the fund now and that it is a legitimate and terrific investment option for them. We'll continue to grow the fund from there to a bigger size, because I think we really are doing something special.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks. Great to talk to you, Alan. Thanks for taking the time.
That was Dr. Jerome Lander, who is the portfolio manager for Lucerne Alternative Investments Fund.